TFM.
Welcome, Stargazers, to another episode of The Artificial Tango, our dedicated Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I hope you're thirsty. Maybe you want to relax a little bit. I've made some tea for us today. Would you like a cup of Celestial Seasonings Warrior Time?
You know what, Chris? I think I'm just going to stick with the whiskey tonight.
that might be a good idea.
I appreciate it. Yeah. I'm going to channel Will and John Luke there at the beginning of the episode with a nice whiskey.
Okay. Well, that might be a good idea, and it'll help you do the other thing I wanted to ask you to do. I just want to make sure, as we start our discussion today, just keep us squirrely.
Oh, okay. I mean, I can absolutely do that. I have no problems with being squirrely. Anybody who interacts with me on Twitter knows that.
All right. Well, let's jump into the third episode of Star Trek Picard Season 3, 17 Seconds. And there's so many things to talk about here, but probably the discussion between Beverly and Jean-Luc is kind of the centerpiece, at least coming out of the last episode, in terms of things that we were wondering about and how they were going to position Beverly's choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved that idea. You know, I was immediately brought back to the idea of Sophie's Choice, the film, and the idea that Beverly's choice here plays so much into this whole season. And I guess the way that I want to tackle this is to just deal with Beverly's rationale first and foremost, because I think it's very interesting that for her, I think we finally have an unveiling of Beverly's emotional state that we've never had in the series. And of course, you know, TNG never dealt with the emotional resonance of the characters, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the closest we really get to that is some episodes with Picard, where I think of family. I think of the episode where, and I can't remember the title off the top of my head, but where the woman that he falls in love with, you know, he has to send to her death. You know, they play music
lessons,
together.
And, right?
Lessons, thank you. And so you do have some of these places where you kind of get into the emotional heartbeat of these characters. But so Beverly says to Jean-Luc that they were on basically what she realized and knew to be their last day together romantically. Mm-hmm. And she finds out she's pregnant. The next day, Picard's life is put in danger. Mm-hmm.
She didn't find out she was already pregnant that day.
So the next few days, his life's put in danger again and again. And she realizes that his life is going to continuously be like this, mm-hmm. that the galaxy is going to continue to call on Jean-Luc Picard and put him in danger. And he's going to answer the call every time. And that she doesn't want this for her son. In fact, she's not quite sure if she can protect the son of Jean-Luc Picard. She thinks she can protect just the son of Beverly Crusher. Mm-hmm. And putting on top of that, the fact that she lost her parents, she's lost her husband, her other son is now a traveler who she barely ever sees. Mm-hmm. And she has all of these issues to which then accentuate this decision of what to do with this son. And she never actually gets the opportunity to tell Jean-Luc, and I think the thing about this is that it does make sense for this character when you start to think about everything that we know about Beverly, that she would make this decision. When you think about her age and the fact that obviously this is the last opportunity she's going to have a child, mm-hmm. and she wants this to turn out differently. She also wants her son safe. And so she acts in a way that she rationalizes, right? Like, there's a lot of rationalizing in the conversation. She's actually rationalizing, you know, by throwing in Jean-Luc's face what he's told her about his father. Like, he doesn't want to turn mm-hmm. into his father. That's why he didn't want a family. And so she's using all this as her rationale for her actions. They're not all bad, but I think that, to me, it is very clear that she makes absolutely the wrong decision, because she takes away Jean-Luc's rights as a father. Mm-hmm. She talks about her rights as a mother yeah. and wanting to protect her child and protect her child. But this is not just her child. This is their child. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Picard has no idea and is left out of every single decision made with his own child, I think is the thing where her arguments all fall apart. And I actually think you can see that in Gates's performance. Mm-hmm. Everything she throws at Jean-Luc, it's with a face that she makes kind of after she's finished speaking of like, I know that was BS what I just said to you, basically.
Right. She realizes
it. Doesn't mean
it.
I didn't feel it, yeah, but it still was not a good reason.
Yeah. I felt that way too, watching it, that in the performance, she conveyed the fact that Beverly realizes and I think regrets those decisions. But as time goes by, as years go by, it's harder to turn around and change direction. And in the Star Trek universe, it's especially so because you're out in deep space. It's not like you're in the same town or in the same country with family, and you can just decide to change a decision that you made. And a lot of what she says and those choices and the fears that she felt resonate with me because of some decisions I've had to make in my life as well, involving some family. So not something I want to go into here, but it resonated with me. I thought it was an interesting mm-hmm. approach right. to the situation in the story. And what I also, watching this the first time and just seeing what the explanation was as to why she had cut everyone off for 20 years, it was interesting that this is the explanation that they went with, because when you and I were discussing the certainly the first episode, but I think maybe when we were discussing the preview before we actually saw the first episode, the explanation of why Beverly had cut everyone off for so long would need to be something that would not make fans view Beverly in a bad light or right. hate Beverly for what she did. And I think that, at least for a lot of viewers, what she did will make them feel that way about her. Mm-hmm. It feels like, wow, I can't believe that she did that. But at the same right. time, I think what she did is a very human reaction right. and a very human decision. So
yes.
I like it from a writing standpoint, because it's actually making these characters real and it's giving them faults
yes. Yes.
that the next generation mm-hmm. would never give its characters.
Yes.
And so that's great. But it was a little bit unexpected. Like, I was expecting it to right. be more of like the things that we discussed before, where it made more, it had a connection to some kind of, she was protecting Jean-Luc because she had discovered something, like you said, about the Iremotic syndrome or something like that. And instead, mm-hmm. it's just like, I wanted to protect my child, which is a motherly instinct. And also, I want to say a parental instinct, because
yes.
I think that I put that down in my notes, because as a father, I also understand. And, you know, one decision that I had to make many, many years ago was about protecting my son and from someone in the family who I felt was maybe it would be best if he weren't around them. And And anyway, as a parent, I understand her position. And I can just imagine fandom today. I can imagine viewers watching this and being all up in arms about it from many angles, including the angle that Beverly's position of feeling this way because she's a mother and having lost a husband and then lost a child and she doesn't want to lose the other child. Some people may see that as an antiquated view because that's not how women should think in our society in 2023. But I think that it highlights how different people have different views of their role in life and the path that they want for their life. And so I think it's very valid to have this here. And I think that Gates McFadden portrays it very well.
Well, I think, you know, Riker tells Jack, everyone is a flawed human. And I think the beauty of this episode is there is a lot of parallel going on in the different characters. And Beverly is a flawed human who makes a flawed choice here. You mentioned earlier, but she lets that fear make her decision for her. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think she's dead wrong, but you can understand it as a human being. I think the beauty of this is that we're learning that these TNG characters are human after all. Mm-hmm. They're not gods. They're not perfect beings. They're flawed human beings living in a flawed universe, and they don't always make the right choice. And I think the beauty of this story, too, is that the older a person gets, the more you start to think about the reality and the way in which your actions have consequences.
Exactly.
And so this weighs, I think, very heavily on Beverly, which rhymes. I didn't mean it to.
But that's a good point, because at the time she made the decision, I'm sure she felt this is exactly the right thing to do. And 20 years later, she realizes that making that decision unilaterally not only has impacted Jean-Luc, but it's impacted Jack. There's that part there where she tells Jean-Luc that when Jack was old enough, she told him, she said, I told him who you are. And I encouraged him to find you, and he chose not to. And I thought that was a ridiculous thing to say, because obviously he's not going to go seek out Jean-Luc, because to him, Jean-Luc is the father that disappeared and that was never there. And Beverly is responsible for Jack feeling that way.
Yes, 100%. No, and I that's one of those places where I felt what she said comes off so weak, because in many ways she's blaming her own son for not reaching out to the father she never allowed him to know. That's her fault.
Right. Yeah.
It's the way he's been raised to which has kept him from knowing Picard. And then when you look at the other side of that, we know that Jean-Luc was raised in a place and with a family to which had him feeling a sense of abandonment by both of his parents. This is the reason that Jean-Luc Picard has been so closed off his entire life. And so here, his abandonment issues have been multiplied again. One by Beverly, who left him 20 years ago without explaining anything to him. And as he says, leaving him thinking to himself the rest of his existence these days, what did I do wrong that she didn't even want to be my friend anymore? We had always been able to stay friends, even if we weren't lovers. And so feeling that. But then two, when he learns that Jack chose not to know him, that just compounds the sense of abandonment that he must feel, the rejection that he must feel, not only from Beverly, but now his own son, who seems to want to have nothing to do with him. And so I think what I was most surprised here is how well Jean-Luc actually handles this situation when you think about the emotional trauma that has just been sprung on him 20 years in the making, and he didn't even know it.
Now, on Beverly's side, I do think So I said I think that was a ridiculous thing for her to say, because I actually felt like the way that it's portrayed by Gates, that Beverly believes that Jack should have been able to go find Jean-Luc and get to know him, and he actually right. chose not to, which, of course, if you're... And she says when he was old enough, so I'm guessing that I'm speculating, but it's not the age he is now. It's probably when he's like 12 or 14 or something right, like that. Right. Of course, a kid at that age thinking that their father abandoned them is going to harbor resentment and isn't going to go out seeking
right.
that. You know, I personally, my father disappeared when I was 10 years old, and I didn't see him again for a decade. And it took time to heal that relationship. And we became close friends, but not like a normal father-son relationship, because we lost
right. like,
all the years when I was growing up. So, but apart from that, I feel like, yeah, Beverly, I think, she knows she made the wrong decision, and she's for a long time been grappling with that. That may be why in the first episode at the very beginning, we see that like she's got Picard's mixtape mm-hmm. on and
right.
listening to logs and so forth. And also there's that moment where Jack is talking to Riker, and Jack tells him that, you know, sometimes my mother tells me stories about all of you, and she kind of lights up, but then she gets sad and then she gets quiet mm-hmm. again.
Right.
So you can tell like that she really misses these relationships that she let right. go of. And it's probably been eating away at her over the years. And then it's gotten to the point that we're seeing right now.
Well, and I do think that what you see there, and it's clear to me that I think that she still has feelings for Jean-Luc. I mean, nobody would
sure.
be listening to a mixtape that somebody gave them 20 years ago,
yeah,
as well as their logs, if they didn't still love this person in a way that's beyond just friendship, that is romantic, that is, you know, the type of marital love that you would want to have. I also think, too, that the gorgeous thing about this whole section of the show is the fact that, you know, Riker tells this story about his own son being born and the 17 seconds it took for the turbo lift to get him to the sick bay. And that was the moment he became a father. And mm-hmm. Picard experiences that same moment here when he believes that his own son, and it looks like his own son, is possibly dying and could die.
I actually thought for a moment that he might, because I felt that if he were to die, I can see a path for the story for Jean-Luc and Beverly that way. And so I think that, but overall, I felt like he would continue through the story.
Right.
But I thought they did an effective job of building it up and mm-hmm. making you wonder.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's a beautiful moment because it's the moment where Jean-Luc becomes a father. In fact, there's mm-hmm. a gorgeous moment in that where he's okay, Jack is okay, and Beverly looks at Picard and he looks at her, and there's this moment of like family being created.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it feels like. It's like the connection is there and I don't know. It was something really special. And you know, just like we talked about with the second episode, I think this episode, just the portrayal and the relationship between those two and the way in which they are able to act even without saying anything, just by look, is really incredible. So I got to give credit where credit is due. Patrick Stewart and Gates McFadden are really bringing this to life in an incredible way. And mm-hmm. so much of it is them not even having to say a word.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I saw someone, they took the footage. Where did I see this? It was probably on Twitter. They took the footage of when Beverly walks in with Wesley at the beginning of TNG off the turbo lift, and Jean-Luc and Beverly are exchanging, you know, looks, and they put this underneath it, and it was, or they put the moment in the previous episode when she comes out with Jack behind her from the turbo lift under the bridge, above and below each other. And it's uncanny how similar those scenes are.
Well, and it just speaks to exactly what Terry Metalis and the creators here for season three have been going for, which is to pay homage to all of TNG as well as the 24th century as we knew it with Deep Space Nine and Voyager. And I think that's really great. It's it's everything that fans have wanted. Yep. And so I think that it's such a comforting thing to have that.
So let me ask you one more thing before we move on to other parts of the episode about Beverly and Jean-Luc and Jean-Luc's reaction to all of this. If we didn't have Picard season two and Picard had not found closure for that fear of loss and fear of intimacy that had been weighing him down throughout The Next Generation as a TV series and through the films, do you think he would have reacted the same way here to finding out that Beverly had hidden away his son for 20 years? Would he have been as reflective and remorseful that he had lost that 20 years of an opportunity to be a father? Because prior to what we saw in season two, I'm not convinced that he really would have wanted to be a father, because of the fears of what happened to him in his own family life. And also, again, that responsibility he felt for the death of Beverly's husband.
I think that, you know, Jean-Luc brings this up himself. He says, you don't know what would have happened 20 years ago. I may have been able to figure this out 20 years ago if you had given me the opportunity, but you didn't even give me the choice. You took it away from me. And I do think that, and I know for many people, having a child does help them confront a lot of their past that makes for a better future. Mm-hmm. And Jean-Luc says, I know now that I would never have become my father. And I do think that he would have been able to learn that 20 years ago, but he wasn't given the choice. And I think that's the saddest thing about this whole bit is that, and I think it's kind of sad because I think it's all too common for men to not even be given the choice of how to deal with the children that they've helped create. And so therefore, Picard is a representation of that. A man who was never even given the choice to make the right choice. And he was judged before he even got a chance. And so I do think that, I do think he could have. I think it would have been more difficult, right, as a story for him, just in general. But I think he could have been able to get there.
It was just something I was thinking about and I was wondering, because clearly what happened to him in season two changed him and changed his openness to situations that could still cause him pain. And but I think that that also, they connected, at least they connected what happened in season two well to the story in my eyes. So it's that continuation. It's like, again, we're drastically rethinking the tone of what Star Trek Picard is, but we're not forgetting what we did in previous seasons. Still there.
No, I 100% agree with that. And I'm glad that that's the case. And I thought about the same thing, is that the way in which this connects with the emotional journey that Picard went on and the second season. And part of that too, I think, is that I think the theme of fear is so rank in this episode.
Yeah.
Because so many people are acting out of fear. We saw Beverly acting out of fear with the choice that she made. Mm-hmm. And Riker is acting out of fear here. And I think, you know, it turns out Yoda was right, because when we make decisions out of fear, instead of truly taking in all this information and then acting out of courage and bravery, bad things happen. Bad choices happen.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is that, you know, as you were just mentioning, Picard's fears were completely explored in that last season. And they're the same things that truly kept him from being able to have a relationship with Beverly. And now we're seeing it as well, her fears that kept them from being able to have a family and a son together. And so that, I mean, that's just one part of it. Like, fear has destroyed a family's ability to be a family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I really appreciate that this season's dealing with that, because we also, we end up with Riker kind of being in the same position. His feelings about what happened with his own son, watching Picard, you know, not taking advantage of the fact that his son is still alive and that's got to eat Riker alive, knowing, like, as any parent would, he would do almost anything to have his child back that was lost.
Mm-hmm.
He would do anything to reconnect with his son if that was a possibility. And so, in some ways, I think the fear he has now is, okay, I can't be responsible for this crew not getting home. And I think there's also a fear of, we know that there's a tension in the relationship with the Riker family.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he wants to die knowing that he didn't get an opportunity to mend that relationship.
Right.
And so fear is leading his actions in this episode, and it allows him to not be at his best. And so I found that the way in which the writing has created these mirroring relationships and mirroring themes and characters is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Well, Picard and Riker really have flipped places here in terms of the tactics, because the Riker that we knew before would have been aggressive. You know, he's the one that's going to ram it down their throats, as he says in Insurrection, right? He isn't going to look for an opportunity to run, which is what he's doing here. And then we see Picard here, who is a lot more aggressive than the Picard that we have known for most of the time that we've known the character of Picard, where he really wants to go on the offensive. He wants to fight. He wants to take advantage of the opportunity, not to escape, but to shut the Shrike down if possible. And I think we saw that transformation of Picard taking place through the films. But I also wonder here how much of that has to do with the fact that, even though we don't talk about it much on screen anymore, he died and he's an android now. And if that changes his perspective in any way.
I don't know. The way I read it, and I could be wrong, is that Picard comes back to the bridge. His son is alive.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, he has everything to live for. And
right.
It is clear that the Shrike is not going to stop pursuing him or the Titan.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the best tactical option and the best chance of success is to use every advantage to their advantage. They find out that they have this advantage in that they're being tracked, this old trick, blood in the water. Mm-hmm. And they can then utilize that against the enemy and then be able to surprise them. It's the oldest trick in the book, surprise attack. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's Riker who is unwilling to do so because of his emotionally compromised sense of protection with everything that's going on. And so I think you have these two competing ideals. And I personally think that Picard is right. You know, and he's right because I don't think that the Shrike being able to continue on whatever mission it's on, which we still don't know, is better for the rest of the galaxy as well. It's not just about what's happening here with Picard and the Titan.
Right.
So I think Picard is thinking about the immediate as well as the expansive view of if this ship and its crew is able to continue on whatever crazy ass mission it's on. and so which we still don't really truly understand yet, right. Other than they're involved in most likely a plot to try and bring down the entire Federation and or just Starfleet. So that's not good.
Yeah.
I read Picard in a much more positive light than I did Riker, and mainly it was because I felt like Riker was making his decision out of fear instead of what was actually best for the situation.
Yeah. Well, in that sense, what you describe about Picard knowing that the Shrike is probably involved in doing something much bigger than just chasing the Titan and attacking them, and he wants to stop them, it reminds me of his view of the Borg in First Contact, right? Like, you have to stop this menace. We can't let it go on. I found it interesting here that Riker starts to act a lot like Shaw, where Riker...
That's a good point.
Yeah, Riker was frustrated with Shaw because Shaw wanted to play it safe and run away, and Riker didn't want to do that.
Run away! Run away!
But then, now that Riker is in command of the ship, he's now taking the same approach. You know, he wants to protect the ship and protect the crew and get them to safety and not take unnecessary risks. And the speed at which that transformation took place, like, I can overlook it because it's a television show and we've got 10 parts to tell this story and it's not real life and it's not a novel and we can't drag out the transformation too long. But it happens a bit quickly, I feel. And also, the way things happen to Shaw... actually, I don't want to get too far down this rabbit hole yet because I want to go back to the Picard thing for a minute. But the way things happen to Shaw, you know, Shaw gets thrown because they still don't have seatbelts on starship bridges. And he's injured and he has to transfer command over to Riker, which works well for the story. But it's a sudden twist, just like we had the sudden twist where he acquiesced to Picard when Picard overrode his commands and said that they were going to stay and face off against the Shrike. So there are these moments where, you know, the writing sometimes feels a little bit jerky, I guess, because you need it for the plot to move forward. I do wish it would be handled a little bit more smoothly in those moments. But back to the confrontation between Picard and Riker, most of their back and forth where they're disagreeing, I think, works well because, first of all, they've known each other for so long. They've worked together for so long. And as we're discussing, there are a lot of factors underlying their mental state and their view of the situation. And they're not going to agree on everything. I think that's a misconception, a big misconception in our world these days, driven by social media, that somehow we all have to agree on everything all the time. And if we don't agree with each other, then we're at odds with each other rather than us just being human beings who aren't going to agree 100% all the time on everything. So I think that works quite well. What I didn't like was after the Shrike uses the portal weapon and redirects the Titan's photon torpedoes back at the Titan. And then Riker tells Picard to remove himself from the bridge. You've just killed us all. I thought that was an extreme reaction from Riker because I don't think Picard made the wrong decision they didn't know that this portal weapon could be used in that way. And even if there was a chance of that, I still don't think it was the wrong decision. And Riker's the captain. He's the one that gave command to fire the torpedoes in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So I think that Riker's reaction in that moment is one of anger and frustration at himself, and he takes it out on Jean-Luc.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I also think that it's interesting because he also sees the wisdom in what Picard had already said, which is that we should go attack them. We should use this to our advantage. He realizes that he did make the wrong choice by not being more decisive earlier, and therefore costing them the opportunity. And so really, yes, this does fall down on his shoulders because he is the captain at this moment. He is the one making the decisions. It is not Jean-Luc making the decisions. And I think he takes his anger out on his friend, which so many of us have.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not right, but it's absolutely what happens. And I would also say, too, I think we also forget that this is 20 years since we've really seen these characters together, and they've all had lives that have changed them dramatically. Mm-hmm. Last episode, we had Jack, you know, ask Picard, is there anybody that you knew 20 years ago who's the same?
Yeah.
And no, they're not. And I think we're absolutely in, and the beauty of this episode is it actually gives us the rationale for why Riker isn't the same.
Mm-hmm.
He suffered a major loss with his son, which is still very fresh. And I feel like in many ways, he might feel like he didn't do enough to help save his son, do whatever it took to save his son. Mm-hmm. You know, damn what Starfleet thinks about, you know, positronic matrices and whether or not they're good or not.
Right.
And so I think that all weighs on him very heavily. And it's been exacerbated by the fact that his friend now has a child to which he at that moment had seemed to not really care about the fact that he had found out he had a son.
Right.
And so there's all of these mixed emotions and it comes up and it's just, you know, sometimes it's too much and you react in a way. And I have no doubt that by the next episode, they're going to have a conversation and Riker's going to be like, I'm sorry, I was wrong. And but that's what friendship is, right? That's what relationship is about. Like you said, it's not like we're never going to disagree, but it's about being able to come back together and admit our mistakes, admit when we were wrong, admit we were wrong. And then to be able to find a way to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of true friendship.
Right. And there's also the fact that Riker's looking at Jean-Luc, someone who died and then was saved by positronic technology when Thaddeus died and wasn't saved because he couldn't access positronic technology.
Yep.
So that could be going on in the back of his head. Anyway, so yeah, my point here is that I don't like Riker's reaction, but the writing is fine because, again, it reflects real human beings.
It reflects what's happened, and I think them having swapped places in this episode is really interesting to watch that happen. And we see Riker kind of, I think, in many ways, mishandle the situation. And it'll be fun to kind of watch that play out in the next episode. But I had one question that, you know, Jack brings up this idea of, like, he says, I've learned to never meet your legends. They always let you down. And obviously this season is all about legacy and legends. So how do you feel about that? That idea, do you feel like they're laying it on a little bit too thick, or do you feel like it's the kind of question that we should be asking in light of this being the final season for these characters?
Do you mean in terms of them being legends?
Well, not just the in terms of them being legends, but I guess my question is more along the lines of, do you feel like the writing is kind of laying it on a little thick?
Yeah, I do a lot of the time. We talked about this maybe the first episode discussion about the difficulty of walking this tightrope between nostalgia and paying homage to the cast and the characters, and then telling a new story at the same time. And I still think they're walking that tightrope pretty well. There are moments where it feels a little bit too much, but you know, I'm a creative professional, so I'm very critical about this type of stuff, and especially my own work, I'm very critical. Mm-hmm. So I'm very aware of it, and I try to step back from that and think about it from the point of view of the average fan or the average viewer, someone who doesn't work in a creative field, is not a writer. Right. And if I look at it that way, I think they're doing a pretty good job. I think that they're giving fans what they want. And I think every once in a while, if we're looking at it with a very critical eye, it can feel like it's a little bit heavy-handed. But at the same time, it's also fun. So mm-hmm. Now, overall, I've been fine with it.
Well, and I think, you know, it is an interesting thing, just because Riker says he's the best man I've ever known. Mm-hmm. And Jack's like, really? Because in his mind, there's that childlike thing of, well, he, even though he may know his father didn't abandon him, we actually don't know the whole situation, exactly what Beverly told him and whatnot, but he may have that feeling, right? And so for him, you know, the idea of Jean-Luc Picard, you know, he may only know Picard from his logs. You know, he may mm-hmm. only know this legend, and meeting him in person is disappointing so far. Because you would build that up in your mind as a kid, that when you finally met your parent finally. And so, I mean, I think it is an interesting question to be asking. In general,
yeah,
well, I do sometimes feel like it is a little bit heavy-handed, but I'm gonna let it go.
Yeah, well, I mean, just imagine how David felt when he found out that his father was, in fact, not an overgrown Boy Scout. You know, he mm-hmm. had that image built up in his head, and it turned out just not to be the case.
Exactly.
He didn't.
Yeah, it's a great point.
A Kirk, he beamed into the middle of that moon with no merit badges. I mean, so he didn't disappointing. Even have, yeah. For David.
Did he even have a pocket knife with him? Come on.
Nah. Well, he didn't need a pocket knife. He had an apple and he had Spock. So
it's true. That's true.
But no, yeah, I get what you're saying. And for me, more so than that bit with Riker talking about Picard, it's the stuff about LaForge's daughter saying, "My father's one of the greatest Starfleet engineers who ever lived." That I thought was a little bit much. But the part about Riker talking about Picard, I thought made a lot of sense, because
mm-hmm. right.
we've all been in those situations where someone has told us that this person is one of the best people that I've ever known, and or this person is so wonderful, and then your own experience with that person may be very different. And so I think that mm-hmm. it highlights how perception matters, experience matters. I also liked here where Jack very self-righteously, like he thinks he knows everything, asks, first of all, he calls him Riker, and Riker says, "Feel free to call me Captain." Mm-hmm. And then he asks him, you know, "Do you have a family?" And Riker says, "Yeah, I do. I have a wife and a daughter, and I had a son." And I loved that moment, because it was just like a slap to Jack of, don't assume that you know everything about somebody.
Exactly.
And that's the other, that is another big problem in our world these days. Again, very prominent in interactions on social media. People act like they know somebody else, but you don't know what's going on in someone's life. You don't know their background. You don't know what losses they may have faced or what challenges they have. There's so many assumptions made. And I felt like this was a moment where that was acknowledged in the script.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. This leads us to, I think, a really big discussion, obviously, is the changing faces. Mm-hmm. We learn that it is the changelings that are behind this, or at least a faction of them.
A faction
we
of
learn,
them. Yeah.
Yes, that after the Dominion War, a terrorist faction had broken off from the Great Link because they had refused to accept defeat. And Odo, a trusted friend of Worf, had warned him of this threat, and Starfleet had acknowledged this faction, but they don't want to instigate another war, so they've kept it quiet because they know that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why it obviously seems as though Worf is working in concert with Starfleet Intelligence as a contractor to try and figure this out quietly so that they can hopefully avert a whole war. So what we end up finding out is that the portal weapon that was stolen, of course, by changelings. And it's most likely just a diversion, that they probably stole something else from Daystrom Station. And Worf believes that they're targeting Starfleet, which I think all leads to the fact that we're having Frontier Day. And then, of course, that would be most likely the target some way. So the fact that we brought changelings back, talk about one of the best ways to honor Deep Space Nine
right.
by bringing back, I would say, the best villain of the Star Trek universe, the Dominion,
mm-hmm.
or a part of the Dominion. This is just phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah. The Dominion as a whole, I would say, is perhaps the greatest villain because of its complexity and its many faces with the changelings and the Vorta and the Jem'Hadar. I love that this is what they turned to. And I also like that they've given it a twist, and it isn't just simply like the founders want to restart the Dominion War. You know, there's this breakaway mm-hmm. faction, and they don't seem to really want to start a war. They just want to get retribution against the Federation somehow. And it makes them more like a terrorist organization than mm-hmm. a full-on
yeah.
enemy. They're not like an enemy state, like the Federation versus the Dominion and the Dominion War. I didn't go back and listen. I think when we discussed episode one, I said that it seems like maybe those Fenris Rangers and the Klingons and the Starfleet officers, they sound like changelings or
yes.
some other species that has shape-shifting abilities like that. And at that point, I was thinking, it seems like changelings, but I didn't think that that's where they would go with the story. And so I started looking for other avenues for what it might be. And I still think there's more complexity to this than just the changelings, because I don't know what the changelings would want with Jean-Luc or his DNA or whatever it is. Because, again, Jean-Luc asks Beverly, what do they want with Jack? And she said, I don't think it even has anything to do with Jack. I think it has something to do with you. And so I don't know what the changelings would want with Jean-Luc, although you and I have discussed a few ideas, which we'll get to in a moment. But there seems to be a lot of stuff going on here. I love the fact, though, that the changelings came back. Again, like I said about the Ferengi last week, I love the updated look, like when their face moves, and then when the changeling, the human that they're interrogating, actually returns to liquid state. I love the updated effects of it. Again, it feels just like a modernization of what we know instead of a redesign. Mm-hmm. And I really like that.
Yeah, I think all of this really works. And I think that what's interesting is that by answering one question, we do raise another. And you said it succinctly is, why would they be after Picard? What does Picard have to do with this?
Mm-hmm.
And it does make me wonder, we know that one of the last missions, apparently, of the Enterprise C, or the last mission, was something that was classified. So does it have to do with that? Did the Enterprise E have a mission during the Dominion War that had a major impact on the war that we don't know about? Because we really don't know anything about what the Enterprise was doing,
mm-hmm.
other than the little that we got in Insurrection. And so there's absolutely a story that you could create there. And, you know, I do think one of the big things is that this is, if you're wanting to pull off something major, Picard himself and his crew have definitely found ways too many times to get in the way of major villains trying to enact their plan. So getting them off the board would make sense. So that's one, but I think there's obviously more to that, and we'll definitely find that out, I believe. And so I think, though, again, bringing the changelings in, just, you know, Terry Metalis had talked about, even before the season began, about utilizing and paying homage to all that had come in the 24th century from Deep Space Nine to Voyager as well. And I think this is a great way to be able to do that, because there was, other than the Borg, which we've already done now, there was no bigger villain in the 24th century, really, in the Alpha Beta quadrants than the Dominion and the Dominion War that happened. And so I think this is a great, great thing to do, which is also interesting because somebody on Twitter had put, you know, the if you freeze frame on the Lekars on Vadic's ship, they're in the Dominion language, as is the, of course, the bomb that gets planted. And so she is obviously a part of this somehow. It makes me wonder if she herself is a changeling. And, you know, I don't know why she'd be smoking, but, you know, maybe she's just a really happy changeling.
Well, no, I have an idea there. You notice she smokes all the time. So maybe the cigarette is just part of her. That's why it just keeps burning and burning and burning.
It could be. It could absolutely be.
I have been giving some thought to whether she's a changeling or if she's a human. And yeah, I'm not quite sure yet. Or is she the female changeling and she's gotten better at doing faces? I don't know.
Well, and it could also be too that, you know, her crew, and the reason when they're wearing those masks because they're Jim Hadar underneath, and you know,
I have been wondering about why they're wearing
that. Would be
the
really
masks.
Interesting as well. Yeah. So, putting all this together, though, I think this is a great choice to bring these villains back, because it creates a lot of questions and it creates a lot of places where fans can speculate out the wazoo, which are going to be crazy speculations that are not going to have anything to do with it. But with the changelings, you have to question everyone. You have to question everything you're seeing, you know, and I think that's what makes for good storytelling. So I'm excited to see. And of course, you know, we had the changeling planted on the Titan, who, you know, blows up the central line there, whatever it is that creates them.
Well, it looked like the warp core. Except the thing is, if he blew up the warp core, the ship would have blown up.
It's
so
not
it's
the warp
something
core.
Else, but they I'm lost warp power. Yeah,
I'm guessing he blew up some sort of like important EPS conduit that is, you know, keeping them from being able to go to warp, and their thinking would keep them from being able to fix the ship before they fall into, you know, the rest of this gravity well, which leads us to the fact that, you know, as Jack is dying, as he's been attacked by this changeling, him and Seven have been working together. They figure out how the Shrike has been following them. We already mentioned the idea of the blood in the water. And he gets attacked and he has this vision of Seven coming to him and these branches forming above her saying, connect the branches. And you know, we kept mentioning over and over again in the episode this idea that we're in a biological and electrical area. You know, this is an anomaly. It's not really an actual nebula.
I love the fact that they say it's some kind of anomaly, because even that is an homage to Voyager, where they just kept running into anomalies all the time. And Harry will say, it's an anomaly. It's an anomaly caused by an anomaly.
Yep. Yes. So I think it's pretty clear to me that Jack's vision here is leading us to the answer. Okay, this is how they get out of the situation that they're in, which is fun. I mean, you know, and again, it's the unexpected of Star Trek.
You need to follow the shrike from branch to branch.
Yes,
keep the bird metaphors going.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But yeah, I think that has to have something to do with the solution of how they get out. Because the first time, it feels a little bit odd. Visually, it feels a bit odd in the episode. And then the second time through, then I start thinking about, okay, what does this represent?
Well, and I think what it does very well is it creates the ability for us to see that this anomaly is alive. Mm-hmm. That there's, you know, and so that the fact that he's having this vision therefore connects to this idea that this is not just an anomaly. This is something that may be semi-sentient and or sentient, and therefore connecting with a character who's at the point of death to tell them, hey, follow the branches and you'll be able to get out of this, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, which is such a Star Trek thing to do, right? This thing you don't understand, you realize that it's actually something completely different than you thought it was. And instead of being dangerous, it ends up being helpful. And it's that whole thing about perception. And so this to me is classic Star Trek in that way, which is good for this type of story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this anomaly or nebula in general, visually, I also like the connections, sort of the reflection of the Wrath of Khan that we're getting in all of this, because again, it feels a bit like, I mean, the coloring is different and such, but the concept of it and how it affects the ships and how it's used to tactical advantage feels a lot like the Mutara Nebula. And there are musical cues, which they're not lifted right out of the Wrath of Khan, but they have very close similarities to musical cues.
Yes.
During the battle in the Mutara Nebula from the Wrath of Khan, which I think is brilliantly done and it's subtle. And if you know it, you get it. And if you don't, then it just sounds like good music for the setting of what you have here. And then also the idea of them coming up behind the Shrike. It's like the Enterprise rising up behind the Reliant. And even the visual on the view screen is similar. And so I love all these subtle and sometimes not so subtle parallels that we're getting to so many past moments and famous moments in Star Trek, which it's just all being blended together in such a great way here.
Yeah, I agree.
We talked a little bit about Worf and his role with Starfleet intelligence and helping them out, but what we didn't talk about is Michael Dorn's portrayal of Worf, the writing for Worf, his lines, and the, I would say, somewhat unexpected character arc that we're getting for Worf that actually makes sense to me, where he's mellowed out 20 years after we last saw him.
I think this is wonderful. You know, Michael Dorn had done an interview where he said a lot of this actually comes from the series that he wanted to do, and that this is the Worf that he was going for in that. And I think it makes a lot of sense because, again, 20 years, a lot of life happens and a lot of discussions have to happen within yourself. You know, he even says he's been working on himself.
I love that one. Yeah.
I think what's beautiful about it is that you can see how the Worf who moved through Deep Space Nine 20 years on from Nemesis has taken all of the lessons of his life and tried to enact them in a way that makes him a healthier, more whole individual. And that's exactly who I think we see here, because Worf was always funny. Worf was so good with the lines, right? The one-liners and the very dry, deadpan delivery. And he still has that here, But what's wonderful about it is there's a little bit of a glint in his eye every time he does it.
Right.
And I think that what we've gotten here is finally a character who finds the joy in life and not just the drudgery.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is more centered in who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And that has created a completely different, not completely different, but a whole individual.
And do you think that that is something that started with his relationship with Jadzia and maybe grew from
yes.
that? And then as he reflects on her now, he over time has learned to love the joy of life in the way that Jadzia
mm-hmm.
did. That was more difficult for him when they were together.
I think that this really does seem to come from everything that he's seen and experienced, from his relationship with Jadzia to all of the relationship with the different characters on Deep Space Nine.
Well, and the guidance from Ezri, of course, because
exactly.
that was pivotal to
yes.
his character evolution. Yeah.
But I think even to being able to see the relationship with Riker and Troy, the maybe even the shortcomings of Picard emotionally as a person, I think that he was able to see Sisko as a leader
mm-hmm.
who didn't have those emotional shortcomings
mm-hmm.
in that way. So I think when you look at this, you can really see so many different areas of where Worf has been and all the different experiences he's had and the way in which it's actually creating the character to which we're getting in this series. And I think this Worf is just fantastic. You know, I think the beauty of it, too, is that every one of his one-liners felt like it fit perfectly instead of being forced.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the beauty of this is a character who's found a way to lighten up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks good on him. And
mm-hmm.
so, and I think Michael Dorn, too, is just having an absolute blast playing this character. And I think that's the thing that makes it really special.
Lightening up is a good way to put it. Of course, with the chamomile tea moment, it works
yeah.
well. But also when Raffi tells the human, do you know how far up your Klingon can shove? And Worf says, I do not do that anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not
exactly.
doing that anymore. And I also, and he gets really good little references in too. Like, I'm pretty sure, first of all, I love it when Raffi asks him about what he's wearing, and he says, it is not warrior gear, it is casual. And she says, seriously, where do you wear that? To a Tuesday beheading? And then later on, he says, beheadings are on Wednesdays. And I just thought, though, that
yes.
the Tuesday thing was a reference to the whole, you know, the deflector dish arrives on Tuesday, the tractor
yeah.
beam arrives on Tuesday, everything is on Tuesday, except beheadings, those are on Wednesdays.
It's the perfect day for beheadings, too. It's in the middle of the week. It's a hump day,
mm-hmm.
you know? So
yeah.
why not create a strange hump on a person's body with no head?
Oh, that's terrible, Matthew. But no, Worf had so many great lines in here. And the calmness with which they are delivered and the cadence.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Dorn has still got the cadence.
Yes.
Even with, you know, Worf would always say, you know, something, 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 but, and then come back down.
Yeah.
And you've got that in here exactly the same. But you can hear the age in his voice a bit
yes.
more coming through. And then the last point on Worf, who I'm sure we're getting a lot more of coming up, is that it was perfect for him to be the TNG / DS9 character here that is the one who is there for the reveal that these are the changelings, because
mm-hmm.
he was part of DS9, because yep. he fought in the Dominion War. A lot of things happened to him as a result of the changelings. And also, of course, he has a direct relationship with Odo, so they were able to introduce that element there where he got information. And, you know, I think if we're looking at the season as being the final voyage for the Next Generation crew, I'm not sure you could do this changeling storyline if Worf hadn't gone to DS9 for all that time. You could do it, but it wouldn't work as well. It wouldn't be as natural of a fit, I think, to connect it all.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you on that front. And, you know, it's true. Yeah, I just don't think you could have had this character be who he is if he hadn't been on Deep Space Nine. And, you know, it's one of those things where you wouldn't actually have this story without Deep Space Nine, right?
Exactly.
Because the story exists because of the Dominion and what we did with Deep Space Nine. So I think that that's awesome. Now, I do want to ask you one question, Chris, before we kind of round down with this one. We do get some de-aging in that scene. And I wanted to ask you how you felt that looked. And if not only with the de-aging, if you might have utilized some fancy voice technology that they have now to be able to basically create dialogue from people utilizing their voice from another time period.
Yeah, I mean, did they not do that at all? Because I do feel like Patrick Stewart's voice sounds more like he did during that time period than it does now. Maybe he's just able to do that because he's such a brilliant actor, but I felt like that was manipulated a little bit.
I don't think they did. I could be absolutely wrong on that, but it did to me, it did not feel like that was the case.
Now, Riker's voice didn't feel that way to me, but Patrick Stewart did. Picard's voice did a bit. As far as the visually, not that my eyesight is any measure of being able to discern details in this kind of thing. But to me, I thought it worked well. Like, I could tell they were doing a bit of de-aging there. And I say I could tell they were doing a bit of de-aging, not because I thought it looked fake, but because I could tell that the characters looked a bit younger than they do throughout
the
rest of the episode.
Well, Riker had not gray hair, too, so that helped.
Yeah, yeah. And the comm badge was... Yeah. Of course, the old style. But Patrick Stewart
and
in particular.
And our new captains or whatever, like he apparently has a new Admiral's outfit on. Mm-hmm. So,
well, you know, there is a rule in Starfleet that all the Admirals, they get new outfits every Tuesday.
This is true.
From Wednesday until the following Tuesday, everyone at the Starfleet Fashion Academy, they just design new Admiral uniforms. I mean, this is well established, Matthew.
It's understandable. I mean, you know, why not?
Yeah. And of course, there's also the belt buckle division, but we didn't get to see that on display.
That's
yet.
True. That's disappointing.
But no, I did. So I did feel that, like, Patrick Stewart, he felt younger. But I think the lighting helps, too. It's not like in the first season where he and Raffi were outside in the sun and they did the de-aging, where I think it's a little bit easier to tell that there's some technology going on there. Mm-hmm. Here, I don't know. I thought it worked well. But I also think Tarkin looks fine in Rogue One, and I know that a lot of people think it looks terrible and that it looks fake. So,
oh, it just... No, Tarkin's fantastic. Tarkin is really... that's the next level. You know, Tron Legacy is really what kicked this off when it did with Jeff Bridges. And... I think that Tarkin's fantastic.
The one that doesn't work is Leia at the end of Rogue One.
Yes, yes. They're actually having to create her face digitally anyway. I think what's interesting is that the actual deep fake technology, just the stuff that anybody can do, sometimes works better than the stuff that studios come up with themselves, which is strange.
That's what that guy that like redid Luke,
right? And then he actually went to work for them.
Yeah, and it looked better than what they did, right?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
So I think the interesting thing to me is that it works fine. You know, however much money they put into this, it is still a television show.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way they can even do half of what you can do in a film with the cost and the time that they have. I think the scene is lit in a way that helps it. It's not perfect, but it's fine. I really don't have an issue with it. The biggest thing I had is I wish, having just watched a few Next Generation episodes previously, as well as Insurrection, Patrick Stewart's voice was so strong and had such a resonance to it, which it does mm-hmm. not anymore. And part of that has to do with his age. There's nothing on Patrick. Sure. He can't help it. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
It's nature. Exactly. So I do wish that they had done even more on that to give him the same kind of depth to his voice mm-hmm. that he just doesn't have now.
Yeah.
I think that would have been nice. But otherwise, I think the scene works fine.
Yeah. I wonder if there is still with the technology, though, if especially on a television budget, if there is a line there where it might come off as fake, like you push it a little too much. Maybe they found the balance.
Maybe. That's a good question. So,
All right. Well, what are your final thoughts, if you have any we haven't covered yet?
I was struck in this episode as I was rewatching it before we talked about it. One of the things that the writing has been able to do in this season is kind of tap back into the more Shakespearean nature of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And even the way that lines are written. And I do feel like some of the lines here in this episode are slightly overwritten.
Mm-hmm.
But that also speaks to the more Shakespearean nature of Star Trek in its classic form.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. I want that more than I want this modern vernacular that has permeated Star Trek, I think, mm-hmm. too much.
Yeah.
Mainly because what that makes it, that means I can watch TOS and there's a timeless quality to it, exactly. regardless of the visuals, yep. because the language that's being used isn't tied specifically to a time period in which I'm in. And so I appreciate that.
Yeah. No, that's a great point.
I think this is a phenomenal episode of the show. I loved it. And I would give this 5 out of 5 punches to a shifting changeling face.
Wow, that is a complex rating, but one that I approve of. So there you go. Yeah, that's a great point about the language and the writing, because some of Star Trek in recent years, Discovery in particular, the language is a bit too contemporary, and it's fine, I think, for most viewers in the moment. But if you go back and you watch it 20 or 30 years from now, you're going to feel that it was written in this certain moment in time, whereas the original series is a great example of it just continues to work. And TNG, I feel, continues to be that way as well, as does DS9. And when we're writing science fiction, unless there's a really good reason because of the setting of your story, not in Star mm-hmm. Trek, but like you're writing some particular science fiction story and you have a good reason to use language that feels like it's very much of in the moment for the viewer, I think it's always better to write in this style, which is more timeless, even if it does, as you say, result in lines of dialogue that sometimes feel like they're a little bit overwritten. I mean, you know, my primary job is I'm an editor and I'm always crafting language, and I edit magazines and I'm crafting for concise language and such, but I don't think you always need to do that if that's not the best fit for the purpose. And yeah, like you say here, that would not be the best fit in all cases. So I like that. But yeah, the episode itself, I thought it was a really fantastic episode. As we discussed, at times it's a little bit heavy-handed with the nostalgia or the characters being legends or references. You know, I mentioned LaForge's daughter talking about her dad. you know, I would rather see her dad than have yeah. her talk about what a legend he is to Seven. But you can really see the homework that's been done in crafting this, because there yes. are just a tiny things in here where you know that they've really gone back and they've done research and they've pulled in this little mm-hmm. reference, or they've matched something up. We even got a 47 in here when the crew member sees the shrike, visually sees the shrike, and she calls yeah. to the bridge and she says, it's at bearing 047. You know, there's your 47. That's in there. So everything that you would want as a Star Trek fan is in here somewhere. But the heart of all this for me is, of course, what we discussed at the very beginning, which was the relationship between Beverly and Jean-Luc. And I just think it was handled really well. It right. went down a path that was a bit unexpected for me. I didn't think they would position Beverly that mm-hmm. way, but I think that by doing that, yeah, they've really been able to tell a human story that will connect with a lot of people. And yeah, they're just making the TNG cast human beings, which is something that
yeah,
we've wanted for so long, and we've gotten in the books, but now we're getting it on the screen. Mm-hmm. So that's really wonderful. So I'm going to give this one 9 branches leading us out of the anomaly.
Fantastic.
All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on 17 Seconds. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcast. So it is a closed group. If you're joining for the first time, please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your comments there with Matthew and me and with fellow listeners. And the way to find it on Facebook is just to type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field. It should come right on up. If it doesn't, just type the whole name, The Babel Conference. You can also find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose the artificial tango, and that message will dance right over to Matthew and me by email. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we would love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not busy meditating with Worf, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero are the places I'm most active. You can also find me, of course, here on the network with Literary Tracks, talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek. The Orb, we're doing a 30th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. You can also find Chris and I on Warp 5 as we have the 20th anniversary rewatch of Enterprise. And then Saddle Up, we're talking about Strange New Worlds. And the 602 Club, where we talk about all of the fandoms we love, not just one. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network talking about Harry Potter. We did the whole series one chapter at a time on Owl Post, and I'm doing Aggressive Negotiations, which is a Star Wars podcast with the great John Mills. But Chris, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me, as you mentioned, here on the network doing all of those shows with you. Also, Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time, and you can find me in many episodes in the back catalog. And when I'm not busy doing that, you can find me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. Twitter is where I'm most active. You can also find me on Mastodon if you're over there. Trekkies.social at C. Brian Jones is my username there. And I'd love to chat with you about Star Trek or whatever you want to talk about. And if you'd like to help us keep this show and everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the network and get involved, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. You can become an associate producer of The Artificial Tango or one of our other shows, one of our rewatches, or get involved in other ways. We wouldn't be here without your help. So thank you to everyone who's supporting us there right now. We really, really appreciate the support. Well, Matthew, I'm going to just enjoy this free fall into the gravity well while it lasts. And next week, look forward to talking with you about the next installment of Picard Season 3.
Chris, that sounds fantastic. Get off my bridge. Recording.
All right.
Jack Crusher's uppercut pants.
Oh, exactly. I like when Seven tells him, "You're insane," right?
Yeah. They have a nice chemistry. It's, yeah. They're definitely working on that that legacy show. So
the Jack and Seven show. And and the captain's favorite
Jack
drink.
And Seven variety hour.
Well, I'm thinking that the captain's favorite drink is it's a bit of Jack Daniels with some Seven Up mixed in. The Jack and Seven.
There you go. That sounds like, yeah.
Okay, here we go.